NATO prepares for next week's summit.
The U.S. and its NATO allies have said that Ukraine's future lies in the alliance. And next week, the group will unveil concrete steps to bring Ukraine closer towards NATO membership.
Plus, Ukrainian forces withdraw from a key eastern city.
The Ukrainian military said their positions in that area were destroyed, and they withdraw to take more advantageous positions and to save the lives of military personnel. Russian forces continue to advance with larger forces and more equipment.
And later, elections in Iran and England. Today is Thursday, July 4th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel's air defense crews were busy on Thursday. Lebanon's Hezbollah said they launched more than 200 rockets and a swarm of drones at 10 Israeli military sites in response to the killing of one of their top commanders in southern Lebanon on Wednesday. An Israeli military spokesperson said Hezbollah's claims were under review. While Israel's ambulance service said there were no casualties reported, a shopping center was struck by what appears to be falling debris. NATO will roll out concrete ways to accelerate Ukraine's eventual membership in the alliance during a summit next week in Washington. The summit will also address top security concerns amid Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine and challenges in the Indo-Pacific. VOA State Department Bureau Chief Nike Ching has more.
As the Russia-Ukraine war rages on with no end in sight, the United States will host leaders of the 32-member alliance for the annual NATO summit that runs from July 9th to 11th in Washington. Boosting Ukraine's security and addressing challenges from China are high on the agenda, according to U.S. officials. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Douglas Jones spoke to VOA on Wednesday.
Whether that's supporting Ukraine in its defense against Russian aggression, whether that's working with partners to ways in which we can build the resilience of allies to confront the threats and challenges from the PRC, whether this is hybrid threats, cyber threats, these are all the issues that we'll be focusing on at the summit.
The U.S. and its NATO allies have said that Ukraine's future lies in the alliance, and next week the group will unveil concrete steps to bring Ukraine closer towards NATO membership. Some U.S. lawmakers are expressing concern about Ukraine's readiness to join the alliance, even as the embattled country commits itself to internal reforms. But the summit's focus is not just on Ukraine and European security. Analysts note NATO is also beginning to explore a larger role in the Indo-Pacific. The RAND Corporation's Stephen Flanagan.
Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of Korea, and Japan are very interested in deepening their cooperation with NATO. And in those areas, not necessarily direct military-to-military cooperation, but some areas of where there is cooperation going on.
In celebration of NATO's 75th anniversary, more than two dozen social media influencers have been invited to observe the proceedings and create content to commemorate the milestone. For Nike Ching, Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News, Washington.
And as the diplomats are preparing to talk about Ukraine joining NATO, Russian forces continue their advance in the Donetsk region as Ukrainian forces withdraw from parts of Chasiv Yar. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
In the early hours of Thursday, Russian forces launched a drone attack across Ukraine. Ukrainian air defense reported they shot down 21 of 22 of the incoming Russian drones. However, one of the drones did hit an energy infrastructure facility in the Chernihiv region, leaving almost 6,000 families without electricity. The Chernihiv region was the main target of the attack. The air raid alert lasted for more than 5 hours during the night. Meanwhile, on the front lines, Ukrainian armed forces withdraw from the canal district of the city of Chasiv Yar in the Donetsk region, where fierce fighting has been taking place for the past weeks. The Ukrainian military said their positions in that area were destroyed and they withdraw to take more advantageous positions and to save the lives of military personnel. Russian forces continue to advance with larger forces and more equipment. President Zelensky said that the situation at the front line remains extremely difficult and Ukraine is still waiting for the weapons promised by partners to be supplied.
Готуємось до саміту НАТО у Вашингтоні, зокрема з точки зору патріотів для України. Провів сьогодні кілька нарад щодо нашої комунікації.
He mentioned they are arriving very slowly. He also said that negotiations with partners regarding more weapons supply are ongoing. He announced important decisions are expected in July, including new air defense capabilities, new security and defense agreements, and preparations for the NATO summit and second peace summit. Zelensky said that there should be representatives of Russia at the second peace summit, but probably not Putin, as according to Zelensky, he is afraid to leave Russia. Also, as Ukraine war against Russia's invasion drags on, Ukrainians are fighting to preserve not just their territory, but also history. Many Ukrainians believe Russia is deliberately attacking their cultural heritage sites and monuments in a bid to erase the country's history and identity as a separate nation. I'll be speaking to an architect and a historian about preserving Ukraine's cultural sites. That story coming up next. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
It's always a great day here at Flashpoint when we get two stories from Anna. As she mentioned, she's looking at the Russian attacks on Ukrainian cultural sites. The attacks are seen as a deliberate attempt by Russia to erase Ukrainian culture and history. She talks with people working to save them. Here's Anna Chernikova with a story.
This monument to Ukrainian politician and historian Mykhailo Hrushevsky in central Kyiv survived a massive Russian shelling that killed six people in 2022. Their lives were lost, but Kyiv architect Slava Balbek is determined to save the things that remind Ukrainians of the nation for which they're fighting. Balbek described the damage, saying the shell hit 80 meters from the monument and shockwave destroyed the site facing the blast. Balbek has launched what he says is a long-term initiative to protect cultural landmarks from Russian shelling by constructing protective shields around them. The shields cover up the marks and the ugliness of war, but also serve as reminders of what's going on. Balbek says the aesthetics in the surroundings, which he refers to as military aesthetics, are also very important. He says they have an impact on the consciousness of people who walk past them. Vladimir Putin claims Ukraine is Russian territory and denies the existence of a separate Ukrainian nation. As cultural researcher Marina Sobotyuk sees it, Putin's forces are deliberately attacking Ukrainian monuments as part of the Kremlin's bid to deny and destroy Ukraine's national identity. How did Russia begin an information war against Ukraine in general, she asks. The Russians began to spread their narratives around the world, she says, that claim Ukraine is Russia's smaller brother, that Ukraine has no history of its own, no culture of its own, and that Ukraine is all Russian. Russia denies its attacks specifically target cultural heritage sites, saying its forces only aim for places of strategic importance. Sobotyuk explains how she sees Russia's playbook. First, Moscow wants to destroy Ukraine's identity. Then, it wants to make Ukraine disappear as a nation. Having observed the cultural codes, she says, one can then take the territory very easily. UNESCO says the monetary cost of Russia's attacks on Ukraine's culture and tourism sectors has reached $3.5 billion since the start of the full-scale invasion. Ukraine's Ministry of Culture says 3,000 cultural sites and objects have either been damaged or destroyed by Russian strikes. Ukraine wants international organizations to increase monitoring and hold Russia accountable for violating parts of the 1954 Hague Convention on protecting cultural heritage sites in armed conflicts. While Russia's attacks continue, Slava Balbek will continue his work to shield Ukraine's monuments. His fear, and that of other Ukrainians, is that unless the international community moves to help protect these sites, Ukraine's history, along with some of its territory, could be lost forever. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll take a look at elections in England and Iran in just a moment. But first, as Russia's war on Ukraine continues and NATO meets next week, Russian President Vladimir Putin was at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Kazakhstan, where he met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. On the agenda was likely Turkey's bid to join the BRICS trading group. And as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the bid has Erdogan playing a delicate balancing act in his relations with both Washington and Moscow.
The summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization gave Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan an opportunity to talk face-to-face with Vladimir Putin. Analysts say Turkey's bid to join BRICS, a grouping of economies that includes Russia and China, as well as Asian, African and South American countries, was likely on the agenda. Putin has close ties with Erdogan, but has warned Turkey over its recent rapprochement efforts with its traditional Western allies. Putin is a strong proponent of Turkey's bid to join BRICS. Analysts say the move is also part of Moscow's strategy to counterbalance Beijing's efforts to dominate the trading group. Ceren Erginç is a China specialist at the Center for European Policy Studies.
BRICS as like the back, China's backyards, because all the countries that the membership invitation was extended were the countries that China wanted to have better relations and China wanted to see in BRICS, which in a way bypassed Russia and India as the other major powers within BRICS big time.
Turkey's bid to join BRICS comes as its decades-long effort to become part of the European Union remains stuck over human rights concerns. The impasse is hurting Turkey's ability to trade, prompting Erdogan to look elsewhere. Attila Yeşilada is a Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners.
What played a role is that he was extremely angry at EU for not advancing Turkey's accession bid and not even giving Turkey a date to update the customs union. It really fits in with Turkey's overall policy goals, which are not only promoted by Erdogan, but widely endorsed with Turkish policy, establishment of not being beholden to any political bloc, either West or the East.
Erdogan is due to attend the NATO summit next week in Washington, where he's expected to reaffirm his security commitments to the West. But analysts say Turkey's bid to join BRICS will be an uncomfortable reminder that Ankara is at the same time looking beyond its traditional Western allies to achieve its goals. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Voting is underway in the UK in an election that could mean the end to the Conservative Party's rule. For more, I'm joined by VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, I understand the polls are not closed yet, but is there any indication of how things are going?
We'll know later on this evening when the polls close at 10 o'clock local time, roughly what the turnout will have been. There are indications across the country that polling stations have been about as busy as normal for a general election. The polls, of course, indicate that Britain is heading for a change of government. The last poll taken before general election day gave Labour a majority of some 212 seats. Now, that would be the biggest majority they have ever enjoyed, and you'd have to go back centuries to find a result where the Conservatives did so badly. So all the expectations are that Labour leader Keir Starmer at some point tomorrow will emerge victorious and will speak to the nation as the country's new prime minister.
So what did Rishi Sunak and the Conservatives do to alienate so many voters?
I think it's a big part of it is time. The Conservatives have been in power for 14 years. Since 2010, there have been five prime ministers just in the last 8 years. So that instability, that turmoil has, I think, put off many voters. And then there are individual events, of course, that have happened across those 14 years. The instability really started with the Brexit vote, Britain's referendum on leaving the European Union, and that forced the resignation of then Prime Minister David Cameron. Along came Theresa May. She failed to get Brexit through as well and was forced to resign. And then Boris Johnson came along, a popular figure. But of course, he was forced to resign after scandals about parties in Downing Street during the coronavirus lockdown. Then came Liz Truss, just a month in charge. The markets crashed as financial markets believed that her promises were unfunded. And then we have the incumbent Rishi Sunak, and he's failed really to inspire the electorate anymore. He's seen as a safe pair of hands, but not somebody who is going to transform the country. And it is a country that is struggling. There is an inflation crisis that has been peaking over 10% in recent years. So people are struggling financially. Unemployment is ticking up. Public services like the National Health Service are in a really bad state. And the problem is nobody really knows where the money is going to come from to fix these things, because none of the parties have pledged any tax rises ahead of the election. And so many financial experts say there's going to be a big black hole and that the parties need to be honest with the people about the financial situation that Britain is in.
Well, with the exception of no increases in taxes, has Labour said anything about how they might govern, what they might do to, in their opinions, turn things around, make things better?
Yeah, there are some key policies that Labour is pushing through. Now, they say they don't need to raise taxes because they are going to stimulate more growth. Well, that's the wish of every government around the world, of course. And again, financial experts have cast doubt on whether you can stimulate that kind of economic growth. Labour plan to invest in infrastructure, in sort of more business development, that kind of thing. And they insist with economic growth, they can pay for more investment. But there are some other key pledges. You might be familiar with the British government's current plan, the Conservatives, to send migrants who arrive irregularly over the English Channel in small boats to Rwanda for processing. Now, Labour have said that they will dump that policy, that it's a gimmick, and instead they will set up a new task force to deal with this influx of migration. Critics have also accused the Labour Party of a bit of a class war in Britain. They intend to add VAT tax, sales tax, to private school fees, and they say they're going to reinvest that money in state schools and employ more teachers.
VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London with the update on the British elections. For more and the latest updates, log on to voanews.com. Henry, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Good to be with you.
It's the eve of Iran's presidential election runoff between ultra-conservative Saeed Jalili and relative moderate Masoud Pezeshkian. The two candidates are both loyal to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and have emerged from a first round of voting that drew record low official turnout at just under 40%. The U.S. says the Islamic Republic's elections are neither free nor fair because its ruling system disqualifies candidates seen as not sufficiently loyal to Khamenei, and because Tehran has a record of rigging and inflating vote tallies, according to independent observers. Kassara Arabi is a researcher focused on Iran's top military force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, at U.S. advocacy group United Against Nuclear Iran. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with him by phone and asked whether he's anticipating another low turnout for Friday's runoff.
We can expect this to take place again in the second round. So despite the fact that Khamenei is really trying hard to increase a political participation in terms of the election turnout, B, revive the manufactured hardliner reformist dichotomy, but really Iranians aren't buying it. As I said, Iranians no longer believe the Islamic Republic can be reformed. They believe that they are two sides of the same coin. But it should be noted, in spite of the fact that the participation numbers are low, in terms of creating the illusion of false competition inside the country. For an external audience, Harmony has been relatively successful. If you look at the coverage international media has given to the election, he has been able to manufacture a bit of an electoral buzz, which is, again, this is a veneer of an election. This whole process is manufactured, but it appears as though, although Iranians haven't fallen into this trap, at least some of the outside world has fallen into Khamenei's trap. So on that count, he'll be partially satisfied.
Just following up on that point about how there is greater interest overseas and the outcome, I mean, it does appear that we don't really know who is going to win, given that Pezeshkian, the relative moderate, got a bit more votes than Saeed Jalili, the ultra-conservative. And we don't exactly know how the votes that were cast for other candidates are going to be cast this time around, if those people come out and vote again. So has Khamenei actually succeeded partly by creating this uncertainty?
Yes, in part so, and in part because, unfortunately, large sections of Western media have just been echoing the regime's own lines about an election, about political participation. But if we actually look at this idea that there's a so-called reformist running for office, and that would make, you know, this is a quote, golden opportunity to change. I mean, let's be real here. Power is completely centralized in absolute form in the hands of the supreme leader and his office, the Beitar Ahbari, and the Revolutionary Guard. And who is Masoud Pezeshkian? I mean, Pezeshkian is an individual who endorsed and supported the suppressive forces in the 2022 Mahsa Amini protests. He sided with the Basij forces, those who were suppressing Iranians on the street. He is a man that played a key role in introducing the compulsory hijab across universities and hospitals in the early years of the revolution. He is a man who has said, I fully support the Revolutionary Guard. He's even worn Revolutionary Guard outfits. So he's not a reformist or moderate in any count. He's put this veneer of reformism on.
So just in response to that, would you say that there is any meaningful difference between him and Saeed Jalili?
No, there's no meaningful difference in terms of substance because, again, strategic policy is all determined by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He's been ruling in absolute form for more than 30 years. In terms of appearance is perhaps the only thing that is different. With Jalili, you get the true essence of what the Islamic Republic is. You get its real face. With Pezeshkian, at least the narrative they're building around him, you get a masked individual, a veneer of so-called reformism. Iranians inside the country don't buy this anymore. Eslah talab usul garo dige tamam majra. That's the slogan. Hardliner reformists, your time is up, the game is over. That's been the slogan inside of Iran. That's why people are boycotting the elections. But outside of the country, this illusion of a so-called reformist can shape Western policy towards the Islamic Republic. It can lead to an easing of pressure on the regime. I think the West, Western powers, are so determined to hold on to this idea that the Islamic Republic can be reformed, that if there was a so-called reformist, it would change the West's policy, but it wouldn't change the Iranian regime's policy because the policy is in the hands of the supreme leader. And he's made it very clear that the regime is becoming more aggressive, more ideological, and more strategically reckless.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Kassara Arabi of United Against Nuclear Iran. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.